Hi, I'm Andrea Loyan, Vermont Edition producer, and I just wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela LaFrac. If you have a family member or loved one with Alzheimer's, you know how devastating this disease can be. It's a brain disorder that slowly destroys a person's memory and thinking skills. Its effects are irreversible. The damage it wreaks on the brain cannot be undone. About 50 million people worldwide suffer from Alzheimer's, and it's among the leading causes of death in the United States. Researchers across the globe are working to better understand Alzheimer's so we can prevent it or slow its progression. Just recently, St. Michael's College in Colchester and the University of Vermont in Burlington announced a pretty major breakthrough from a team of researchers there. By studying spider brains, yes, spider brains, they've gained a better understanding of how Alzheimer's disease develops in the human brain. Two of these researchers are joining us now to tell us about their work, which has been published in the Journal of Comparative Neurology. We have Dr. Ruth Fabian Fine with us today. Welcome.
Hello.
And Dr. Adam Weaver. Welcome.
Hello.
And listeners, you can join the conversation as well. Do you have a personal connection to Alzheimer's? Maybe you're caring for a loved one with it, or you have a history of Alzheimer's in your family that you'd be willing to share. You can give us a call at 800-639-2211 as we discuss the scientific research. You can also send us an email with questions or thoughts to vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. So first, before we get into the spiders and the research, let's talk a little bit about Alzheimer's itself for folks who might know the word, the name of the disease, but don't know very much about it. Ruth, could you start us off? Tell us what Alzheimer's is.
Well, Alzheimer's is the progressive degeneration of neurons that starts usually in the hippocampus, and the hippocampus in the brain is the area that's important for learning and memory. So with other words, it manifests itself in forgetfulness. So people cannot remember things. They slow down with making new memory. And then as it slowly progresses to other brain areas, then other functions are being affected, and then other behavioral manifestations occur. And Adam teaches about this.
Adam, you teach a class that discusses Alzheimer's. Tell us more.
Well, we're both neuroscientists, and so we teach an array of neuroscience-related courses. And my course focuses on physiology and behavior. And so we talk specifically about some of the neurodegenerative pathways and some of the hallmark symptoms, such as the amyloid beta plaques, which are protein aggregations, and neurofibrillary tangles.
What is a neurodegenerative pathway?
Some of the chemical processes that are associated with potentially increased inflammation and over time the death of the neurons that actually do the cell signaling within the brain.
You basically lose pathways that are responsible for certain behaviors. And I give you an example. So people who suffer from Alzheimer's disease, up to a certain point when they have pain, they complain about pain. And at some point, they suddenly don't complain about pain anymore. And then when asked the question, do you not have pain anymore? Then the answer might be, yes, I still do have the pain, but I don't care anymore.
Oh, you see,
so this is the progressive nature of this disease. So the pathway that makes you care about this pain and complain about the pain has degenerated. And that's how you can observe people who suffer from neurodegenerative diseases lose function after function after function, which is actually pretty, I mean, many of us probably know someone in our environment and have observed this. It is, so I've had a friend, she died of ALS, and seeing her progressively lose all of her motor function and not being able to function anymore is traumatic.
Yeah. Oh, I'm so sorry for your loss. And I think you're right that so many of us know somebody with one of these neurodegenerative diseases. Adam, is that did you have a personal connection that has made you more interested in this work, or does it stem from something else?
I do. With my grandparents, suffered, especially on my maternal side, suffered from dementia late in life. And while they were never formally diagnosed, the hallmarks of dementia are still there and were impactful. The loss of memory, the loss of personality, the loss of oneself is quite devastating for loved ones.
Yeah. Well, you both have taken these personal experiences and your own expertise in neuroscience and channeled that into some pretty remarkable research. And when we think about research involving animals, I often think of like monkeys or rats or mice, things like that. You all have been working with Central American wandering spiders. How did that come about?
So the spider work, I originally started that when I was a master's student in Frankfurt, Germany. So there was one lab that worked with spiders, and I recognized the strength of the system because they have such large neurons compared to our neurons. So
theirs are bigger than ours?
Yes, that's really interesting. Our brain is bigger, but in during evolution, as animals became more and more developed, neurons became more, but therefore smaller. Whereas in animals that are lower on the phylogenetic tree of, you know, evolution, they have fewer neurons, but the neurons that they have are huge. And so that's, I thought, that's a great model system. Back then, I was working on sensory systems that are similar to our ears. And that's how the spiders started.
In the last 100 years of neuroscience research has shown there's a lot of conserved principles on which the nervous system works, whether you're talking about a small fruit fly all the way up to a complex animal like ourselves.
Is it in a way easier to kind of study these more simple
creatures? Having smaller numbers of cells, having larger cells, having organisms that you can care for rather readily. The spiders almost care for themselves. It's just a great model system, and it's a system that we pride ourselves in that we're able to work with undergraduates.
And it is a misconception that we have that when people say, you're working with spiders, how could that be significant for humans? You know, there are so many prizes, Nobel Prizes, that have been given for groundbreaking research with invertebrate systems like Drosophila or roundworms or giant squid or the giant neurons in squid.
Or even the sea slug that was involved in learning and memory.
Or gene expression that we would not know had we just focused on mice, rats, and humans.
Wow, fascinating. Yeah. I have to admit, I've been a little too nervous to Google a Central American wandering spider. What do they look like?
They look like fishing spiders here in Vermont. They're fairly big. They are wandering spiders. So these are the spiders that have the big legs, and they're about the size of your hand.
With the legs, of course.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. It's still pretty big. Yeah, but they are nice. So, yeah.
And so before the show, we were talking a little bit about how you, in a way, stumbled into this connection between what you were working on with these spiders and Alzheimer's research. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so we breed those spiders in the lab, and they have a lifespan between 2 and 3 years. And when I came here to Vermont and I brought all my spiders in my car. When I crossed the border, they stopped me and I'm, what do you have in your car?
How many spiders did you have in there?
About 100.
Oh, wow. Okay. You have to declare that, I assume.
I had to get a permit. Anyway, so I came to the lab here, and then I realized that my spiders started to degenerate at the age of one. And so I was seriously concerned that we would be losing the spider colony, and I said to the team, let's investigate why we are losing those spiders. And so we dissected those brains of the degenerating spiders because they are dying fairly quickly, and that's when it didn't take us very long, like 8 months, something like this.
Well, they also had unique symptoms in that they weren't able to hold their body posture. They stopped feeding. And, you know, while they live several years in our lab, in the wild they might live a year normally. And so this was a premature death. We would see frequent premature deaths, and we wanted to know what it was. Was it a parasite in their food source, which was crickets, or was it something else?
Yeah. And then I discovered this canal system, and these canals in the spiders are almost as big as the neurons, so they you cannot miss them.
Brain canals.
The brain canals in the spider brain are almost as big as the neurons next to which they run. And you could clearly see how these canals go into the neurons and take the debris out. And so then we compared the healthy spiders with the diseased spiders, and we realized that it is this canal system that fails in the degenerating spiders. And basically, Adam has this comparison with a vacuum. You know, with
it. Tell us about it.
Yeah.
So we use a lot of metaphors in describing what we do. And one example is a vacuum. So the idea is that, you know, through the process of living, you know, in your home, you periodically need to clean and vacuum out the debris and so forth that builds up, the dust. And the same thing happens with our neurons. As part of their normal functioning, they produce metabolic wastes, and those wastes need to be removed. Or if they build up, they can disrupt the normal function of those neurons, so they can't appropriately
So a little spring cleaning for your brain.
A little spring cleaning. And so these associated cells, glial cells, project into our neurons and form waste removal structures, and they help to pull and draw the debris out. And we were finding that in certain circumstances, the degenerating neurons were potentially either being under they weren't removing enough of the debris, or more commonly, they were actually removing way too much. And so it was basically like vacuuming out the entire contents of your house. And of course, that wouldn't be a functional house at that point.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so draw this connection again for us between this realization and what happens when a human gets Alzheimer's.
So when I discovered this, I thought, that's interesting. So I looked at the neurons in the spider, and then I looked at online pictures of human degenerating neurons in Alzheimer's patients, and they looked identical. And I thought, I want to look into the human neurons and want to see whether they have a similar canal system. And so I also had still some rat tissue from my work in Europe, and I processed the rat tissue as well, and I realized what it was. And I realized that they have the same canal system. And I would never have questioned this. I would never have discovered this without the spiders, because the structures that we've identified until now, we thought were myelinated axons. And I think that is the real breakthrough of this discovery. So what we've basically discovered is that these myelinated cells that run parallel to the neuronal cell bodies, to the, you know, somatic cells.
You're losing me. You're losing me here.
To the you know how a cell has a big cell body and a nucleus in there?
Yes. I generally remember this from bio class.
And these canals run next to this, parallel to this. And until now, we thought that these are axons. So nobody questioned that.
Okay.
But what the link that we could make through the spiders was that these are not axons, that these are these canal systems that are present in rodents and humans.
And just to backfill a couple terms, so axon is the portion of a neuron that sends outputs out to communicate to other cells, and myelination is a process where a cell gets wrapped with many layers of membrane, or has many layers of membrane surrounding it, more than just the normal the normal single layer. And what we were finding is these support cells that were doing the waste removal had many, many layers of membrane, and through lots of work, primarily with Ruth and her, and some of our students, they were able to see that it would those layers of membrane would branch off and go out and project into the neurons, and that that was the site of waste removal.
Let's pause here for a short break. When we come back, I want to talk a bit more about what this realization, this discovery, could mean for how we try to prevent Alzheimer's or what we know about people who have it right now. And also, we would love to hear from you, too. If this conversation is hitting home, maybe you have a family member or a friend with Alzheimer's, or you have studied this type of work yourself, give us a call at 800-639-2211. Our guests are Dr. Ruth Fabian-Fine, the director of the neuroscience program at St. Mike's, and Dr. Adam Weaver, an associate director of biology and neuroscience also at St. Mike's. So figuring out these underlying causes, the structure of what's going on when there's degeneration in the brain, this could potentially affect drug development. What is your hope there for where this research could lead?
Yeah. So I want to point out we are only at the beginning of our understanding of this, but I think that this is a major turn in our research with regard to neurodegeneration. My sincere hope is that also with the paper that we are currently working on, that we will at least kindle the interest of the neuroscience community so that they are, supporting us with our research. And then we've identified some drug targets, some key proteins that are important for this mechanism. You know how Adam talked about the vacuum?
Yeah.
There has to be a pump that sucks the debris in, right? And it is this pump that we are targeting at the moment because this pump seems to work too much, and that leads to the swelling of the system. It takes in too much. And we've just conducted these experiments that will be published in our next paper. So we've done this on living mouse cells, and we've visualized this pump and then blocked this pump, and indeed the cells don't swell on as much. So these
are promising.
Very promising. Yeah.
Yeah. And you two have worked very closely with students as part of this research. Could you tell us about how they're involved?
Yeah. So both of us chose to come to St. Mike's because we knew we wanted to work primarily with undergraduates. We pitched our research questions, our model systems to one that would work at a liberal arts college. And we actively seek students from all ages, all years, to join our lab and participate. And, and through that, they learn new skills that are marketable for graduate schools or for jobs after they actually graduate.
It is also fun to watch them develop. Right. So they usually join very early. And then as they become more senior, they are then training other students. And obviously, it's good for their career to be authors on their work on these papers.
Yeah. This kind of research also occurs across our college. And so we pride ourselves in that at St. Mike's.
Mm. Well, let's take a couple calls here. We have Lou calling in from Albany. Lou, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm very excited to hear new things that I have never heard before, such as the tubules that go alongside the neurons are structures of cleansing and making neurons more free to do their job. It's so exciting. You think of the ways you normally know how things cleanse, either by a dietary change or things that eat up the bad stuff like macrophage. It's all very exciting. So how do we also consider this a great opportunity to promote other people's excitement in choosing jobs that continue this research and learning and finding therapeutic things that we can't even imagine now?
Great question. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that this is something that Adam and I both do actively in our jobs when we teach students, that we involve them in this kind of research. And I will say that many of our students actually stay close and they end up at UVM or they end up working at UVM, at continuing their education and staying in the field. That is a very good point.
Adam, any additional thoughts there?
No, not at this time. Thank
Just
you.
Our current student, Abigail, she wants to stay close and wants to continue with this work.
Nice. Yeah. Good for you, Abigail.
She's very excited.
Well, let's go to Emily in Burlington next, who I believe is actually a graduate student at UVM. Emily, go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted a little bit of clarification in what the canal system that you were talking about. Are you talking about it occurring in like the primary neuron with supporting cells like penetrating that membrane and entering into the neuron itself through like a membrane contact site or like through full membrane fusion?
They actually enter into the neuron. You seem to have a little bit of expertise there. So these are glial cells that are in the lining of the brain between the brain and the ventricle, and they make fenestrations. And through these fenestrations, or little holes, they enter into neurons, and within the neurons, they are making, we call them waste receptacles. And basically internalize and break up debris from the neuron and take it out.
And we would call these cells tanysites, or a specialized form of ependymal cell. They are located in the adjacent to the hippocampus and the alveus, since you seem to have some background.
I was going to make a joke about me being able to take that question. Emily, does that answer your question?
That does answer my question. And I'm also really excited
I'm giving a talk on Friday.
Oh, great. Tell us a little bit more about it if folks want to interact more with you and your research.
Yeah, I'm a pipeline investigator. I'm an adjunct professor at UVM and a pipeline investigator for the Vermont Center of Cardiovascular and Brain Health. And I'm giving a conference talk on Friday at 9:00.
About this work
about
that
this
you two
work
are doing.
And what we are about to publish, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what does it take? Give us a peek behind the scenes of doing this research, feeling like you've really figured something out here, and getting that published in a peer-reviewed journal or kind of making it an official thing that you can announce. Does that take a lot of time? Are we talking years? What's that work look like?
So we've been working, 3 years was when we started to think about this as a new direction, but it's really the last 2 years where it's taken off.
Do you know, if you take it the time frame with regard to when Alois Alzheimer first described Alzheimer's disease in 1906, by the way, he did this work in Frankfurt, where I come from initially.
Oh.
So it was a comparatively short time frame.
Yeah.
However, if you ask me personally, it was long, because when you realize what you see and what you've discovered, and you suddenly put your discovery in place, and you can suddenly explain all of it, what a tau tangle is and what an amyloid beta plaque is and why there are spongiform abnormalities in the brain, it dawns on you that you've made a significant discovery. And I was unable to sleep because I thought, I have to get this out, because Alzheimer's patients don't have time. Mm. We have to push that out. And then you have to fight reviewers that say, no, you're looking at fixation artifacts. And then you push back and you say, but I show it in spiders, in mice, in humans, and in rats. They all show the same thing. So I will be honest, it was psychologically, and still is until this other paper is out, is really challenging. Mm. Because I know people don't have time, and it's just, I want to be as fast as possible to push this forward, which is why I'm so grateful that you are picking this up.
Mm. We also have spent a lot of time anticipating possible criticisms or concerns about our data, and so we've gone overboard with providing evidence that, yeah, it isn't the fixation artifacts, that we have many, many examples, and we're not just cherry picking, you know, the best examples of the data.
Mm. Yeah.
There will always be challenges. And, you know, scientific discussion is important. There's one hypothesis and there's another hypothesis. And then you just have to do the experiments to figure out which hypothesis is correct. But every experiment we've done, I've formulated my hypothesis, predicted my outcome, and it always was the outcome we've predicted, which is why I am so optimistic about this. I see it in spiders, I see it in mice, in rats, in humans, and it's always the same. The same proteins are involved in it, which is what makes me so optimistic. And I am hopeful that if the neuroscience community wakes up to it, that we will be able to push forward fast.
Mm. Does the neuroscience community, does it feel like a community? Are there people, are you aware of all the other types of research going on? Are people constantly in dialogue? What does that feel like?
Yes, there's absolutely a community, and we work together, we collaborate. I will say that the collaboration between St. Michael's College and UVM mm-hmm. and UVM Medical Center and Vermont Biomedical Research Network, Dr. Franklin, who is the director, without their support, without the help, collaboration, Mark Nelson Lab, we would not have been able to push this forward so quickly.
Mm.
And it's the discussions we have with them, the support that it's, and this is what I really love about this and the community that we're in. It's a team effort. It takes a village.
Yeah.
Especially here in Vermont, it's a very supportive community.
Right, right. Adam, when you think a couple years into the future, what do you hope is be done with this research that you and Ruth have been working on? Where do you hope it will be?
I think we're just trying to provide additional evidence from a mechanistic perspective, functional perspective, as well as allaying possible criticisms over the next several years. I know that Ruth is hopeful that we can potentially do drug trials with possibly a collaboration with a pharmaceutical firm on animals, and then potentially try to bring that towards humans. But that can be, unfortunately, a long process.
Mm. Yeah, is that where you see this in the next couple years, Ruth, too?
So that's my full goal. I go full steam ahead because, as I said, Alzheimer's patients don't have the luxury of time. And it might be any one of us. It might be anyone in our family. And I am hopeful that pharma industry will pick that up and work with us on that. I really think that it could go potentially very quickly. Particularly encouraged that Adam just did the statistical analysis of our truck trial, and it seems to be...
It's a very significant impact. The use of the drug actually really stops that pumping mechanism that we referred to, and we think that's actually beneficial in that it gives the support cells that are removing the waste time to process that waste. And it doesn't just build up into a logjam or something where it can't flow.
But then, of course, we still have to now identify why do these abnormalities occur. And we do have a hypothesis that we've actually described in the paper. But so we will have to work further towards a better understanding. You know, if you think about this, these cells, if they internalize waste. They also internalize the waste from their surroundings, not just from other cells, but from extracellular areas. So if we take very toxic medication like chemotherapy, for example, so I came across these papers that have described patients who underwent chemotherapy and then started to show signs of neurodegeneration. And it makes absolutely sense because if these cells internalize toxic chemicals and they accumulate within these cells, the cells themselves might be impacted and die. So these are all things, questions that we have to address and investigate.
Hmm. I'm so glad you two are in the studio with me today because I can see the excitement and the hope in both of your eyes for where this research could lead. Ruth Fabian Fine and Adam Weaver, both of St. Michael's College. Thank you both so much for telling us about this work.
Thank you.
Thank you.